Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th. Spectators can find event info such as start times, race routes, and where to watch, as well as volunteer opportunities at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'll visit with two members of what has become quite a literary family. Sherelle Byers Moranville has just published her seventh novel for young readers. This one is called Surprise Lily, and it's about mothers, daughters, sisters, secrets, and family legacies. She'll join us in a little while, but I'm going to start the hour with her niece, Des Moines food writer Winnie Moranville. She has just published a cookbook inspired by the classic novel Little Women by Louisa May Alcott. The book just turned 150. There's a new major motion picture being released this holiday season, and it feels like the perfect time for the Little Women cookbook. Winnie, hello.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And Little Women is a book that a lot of people read in their childhood. When did you first read it?
I was starting to remember that. I was 13 or 14. I was an early teenager.
And what did the book mean to you?
Well, I just loved this family of sisters. I had one sister, which was great, but I just thought it was so cool that there were these sisters that got to hang around with each other and play together and think of all these fun things to do together, put on shows, explore their artistic sides. I just thought that was it was a fantasy. It just sounded so cool.
And this became a book that you returned to again and again over the years?
I did, especially when in 1994 with the Winona Ryder movie and Gabriel Byrne. That is such a beautiful production. And I can't wait to see the next movie, but it's just going to be hard to top Winona Ryder. She was just so wonderful in that and so moving. I just watched it again last spring when I was working on this book, and it just moved me to tears again. It's just a great movie. So then at that point, I read it again. And of course, I read it last winter when I was working on the book.
Right. And probably in a way that you had never read it before.
Exactly. My editor at Harvard Common Press had called me and asked me on a Friday if I might be interested in doing a book on Little Women, a cookbook with the food in Little Women. And I said, I don't recall that much. I could remember like pickled limes and a few cooking disasters that
right.
Joe had had. But I couldn't remember that much. And then I said, well, let me read it and think about it. He said, okay, I need to know Monday.
I know.
So I read it over the weekend and highlighted. And there was food everywhere in the book. It starts with the family giving away their Christmas dinner or a Christmas breakfast to a poor immigrant family. And it ends with a picnic in the apple orchard. And throughout the book, 450 pages, the food just weaves its way in the narratives of people coming together, of lessons learned, of people cooking for each other, especially they're cooking for their sister, Beth, while she's ailing. And I think one of the most moving moments in food in this is when Jo decides that she wants to earn money from her writing so that she can treat her gravely ill sister Beth to everything that Beth loves. The quote is, from strawberries in winter to an organ in her bedroom. So, you know, food is one of the ways they take care of each other and love each other and show affection to each other.
It's funny, when you said that about not really remembering the food in the book, as a casual reader, I never focused on the food in the book. I remembered the pickled limes, and I remembered the jelly incident with Meg
early in
her marriage. We'll talk more about that in a little while. But it wasn't a focus for me as a reader, but it does show up again and again. And your book helped bring back all of these memories for me of scenes in the book that maybe I didn't pay close attention to because they weren't the most important for me. So it's a fun way to look at the book in a new way.
Well, that's what I absolutely love about Food and Little Women is it's not the focus. It takes its rightful place in the moment. It's not fawned over. It's really just a natural part of the family's life together, which I'm becoming more and more interested in food that way as, not not to show off, not to have status, you know, not to sort of say, hey, look at this, aren't I a great cook? But, you know, I did this for you. I want to share this with you. I want to be with you at the table. And I think that's what I love about it. And one great lesson that, or two great lessons in the book is when Amy brings pickled lime to school, if you remember, she brings them to sort of up her status. It's a status thing. It's like you have pickled limes. You can share them with people. You know, immediately she shares these pickled limes, and she, you know, somebody invites her to a party, and somebody else lends her, I don't know, some, you know, hair accessory or something. And, you know, but it doesn't end well because she gets in a lot of trouble. And, you know, so when you try to use food as status, it doesn't work so well. You know, and same thing with Joe, really trying to, like, put out a grand and glamorous dinner party, and everything goes wrong. And her mother just says to her, suppose you learn simple, honest, plain cooking. And I thought, that's such a great lesson. Don't overreach. So the lessons learned are great in this book.
When you dug into the book and started looking at the foods that were represented in it, you also had to recreate some history. Now, the book was first published in 1868, so right after the Civil War, and there were all of these dishes referred to in the book. And when I read the book as a child, I didn't know what a lot of these dishes were, and I wasn't that curious. You know,
I didn't
look any farther. But how did you even figure out what kind of food they were talking about?
Well, you know, it took some digging. So once I highlighted and made a list of all the foods that they talked about, I went to cookbooks from the time, from 1860 to about 1880, and there are a lot of cookbooks from that era. And I found a lot of great recipes for it, but of course I had to update them in many ways.
Yeah, what are cookbooks like in those cookbooks?
Let me read you one of the recipes for wedding cake, all
okay.
right? Take 5 pounds each of flour, butter, and sugar, 6 of raisins, 12 of currants, 2 of citron, 50 eggs, half a pint of good Malaga wine, 3 ounces of nutmegs, 3 of cinnamon, and 1.5 of mace. Bake in 3 large pans for 4 hours.
And good luck.
I know. Do you whip the eggs? When do you put, you know, I just look at that and think, that's not going to work.
So, right.
Yeah. So there were quite a few. And then there were ingredients like the blancmange, which is kind of like a panna cotta.
And we can remind people of when we were introduced to that delicious dessert in the book. Again, this was something I didn't look up. I had no idea what it was, but Joe offered some to Lori, her next door neighbor boy, when he had a sore throat. It was
right.
supposed to be nice and soft and delicious. So what is it?
Well, it's like a panna cotta. So it's a custard that's thickened without eggs. And how to thicken it back then was you either had to use isinglass, which is a sort of fish bladder. I couldn't find that on the grocery store shelves.
Weird.
And or you could boil some calves' hooves. So neither one of those were going to go in my book. So I used today's method, which is unflavored gelatin, which was very, very simple. But, you know, so there were quite a few things like that where I'd say, okay, well, how do I update that? And that really wasn't a problem because what was surprising to me is so many of the foods people ate then aren't that different than, I mean, we're more global, of course, but there are a lot of foods we still love today that were loved back then. So it wasn't like I was looking through a bunch of really, really weird stuff.
One of the cookbooks that you referenced to get these recipes was actually called out by name in the book Little Women. Again, something that completely passed me by. But of course, there are 4 sisters, and the oldest sister is Meg. She gets married in the book and sets up her own household and does have some cooking misadventures early in her marriage. And there's actually a reference to a real cookbook?
Yes. It's The Young Housekeeper's Friend by Mrs. Cornelius. And I found that cookbook, and it's a wonderful little cookbook. But it had all the sort of recipes that someone who didn't, you know, it's kind of like the Better Homes and Gardens new cookbook of the time, of their time. And that's exactly the cookbook that Meg used. So I drew a lot of recipes out of that cookbook, because that truly would have been what the March sisters would have used.
Wow. Well, and it's funny, again, that just passed by without much notice, because it feels like window dressing.
Oh, right,
when
exactly.
You drill down a little deeper. It's...
Oh, yeah. And that was the fun part of the book, was really sort of saying, okay, well, what was that? You know, what? Because Louisa May Alcott refers to it as Mrs. Cornelius's book, you know, suggested that Meg do this and this and this. And I was like, oh, let's find Mrs. Cornelius's book. And I found it. And
how hard was it to find?
Actually, not as hard as you would think. I wish I could tell you that I went through all kinds of dusty old libraries and, you know, drove all over finding these books. But there's a fabulous digital library called the HathiTrust Digital Library, and it has all kinds of cookbooks. I mean, I spent hours and hours and hours going through them to find what I needed, but, you know, I didn't have to actually find the books themselves, which is great.
There's a reference in the book when Beth is ill, and of course all of her sisters are trying to take care of her in the best ways they can figure out how to do it. There's a line about Meg preparing delicate messes in the kitchen for Beth. And when I read that, I thought, you know, that she's not a very good cook and she's trying hard, but she's making a mess. But that's not what that meant at all.
Oh, not at all.
What is a mess?
A mess is just a cooked dish. It was like when you think of a mess hall or something, this is where people, you know, it's simply a cooked dish. And I don't know why it became, you know, why we translated that to a mess. But at one point Joe says, take a nice mess to the Hummel family. And they're just bringing a nice dish for the poor immigrant family. So it's just a funny word, isn't it?
It is. And it meant something entirely different to me.
Absolutely.
So we're going to have to take a break here in just a moment. But in one of the first pages of the book, you have a picture of Orchard House, which is in Concord, Massachusetts. And that's the house where Louisa May Alcott lived and actually wrote Little Women. And she never got married, so she was still living with her family. Did you travel to Orchard House? Did you go
visit? Oh, I wish I would have had the time. I had exactly 1 month to write this book and test all the recipes and get it out there. Yeah, it was an idea that came up really fast, and it was a wonderful way to spend February.
All right, we are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I am talking to Winnie Moranville. She is a food writer and has just published the Little Women Cookbook. Of course, there's a major motion picture, Little Women, coming out around the holidays, and the book just celebrated its 150th anniversary, so a wonderful moment to celebrate the food in the book Little Women. Winnie Moranville will be back in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th. Spectators can find event info such as start times, race routes, and where to watch, as well as volunteer opportunities at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking to two members of a literary family. Cheryl Byers Moranville has just published her seventh novel for young readers. It's called Surprise Lily, and I'll talk to her in a few minutes. Right now, I'm talking with her niece, Des Moines food writer Winnie Moranville, and we're talking about the cookbook she just published, The Little Women Cookbook. It takes recipes from the classic novel, or at least recipes inspired by the food that appears in the classic novel. And before we move on, Winnie, I want to talk about some of the specific dishes. Now, we already talked about blancmange, or I said that wrong because you can say French names a lot better than I can. But let's talk about some of the other dishes. We mentioned pickled limes, which played such a pivotal role in Amy's social life. And anybody who's read the book remembers probably that really heart-wrenching moment in her life. But you did not include a recipe for pickled limes in the book. Why is that?
Because I couldn't make them taste good.
Did you try?
Oh, yes. I found a recipe in a cookbook, and they were made by curing limes in salt, then rubbing them with turmeric, pickling them with garlic, onions, cloves, ginger, vinegar, and mustard seeds.
And this was a treat that schoolgirls coveted.
Yeah, I love it. Amy says, for example, if one girl likes another, she gives her a lime. If she's mad at her, she eats one before her face. They treat by turns. And, you know, she's begging her older sister Meg to give her a quarter so she can go buy some limes as well. And frankly, I could not make them taste good. I think they'd be a novelty. And I bet you so much that one of our great chefs in Des Moines could do something really clever with that. And, you know, I don't know, somehow put it in a chutney or something cool like that. But, you know, I just thought for a broad appeal and for a book that, you know, I hope appeals to families, it wasn't going to go in my book.
So what did you put in instead?
I did a playful take. I did pickled lime sugar cookies. So a really nice sugar cookie topped with a citrus or lime buttercream frosting. So it's got that zingy, buttery, sweet flavor. And then I top it with, remember those beautiful jellied lime candies that you used to be able to get like at Fanny Farmer and all those places? You can still get them at Beaverdell Confections in Des Moines. And you just take... You quarter those little limes up and put it top. And it's just, to me, that's something a schoolgirl would enjoy sharing with her friends. Not real pickled limes.
All right. So you spent about a month putting this book together, which meant doing all of this research, going back, rereading the novel and writing these recipes, translating them into modern recipes and testing them as well. I mean, that must have been an incredible undertaking. February is a short month.
Yeah, it is. But you know what? It was just wonderful. I would go to bed at night and I was like, I couldn't sleep because I couldn't wait to get up and test and do more recipes. I don't think I've ever been as energized by a project. There was something so exciting about this. And I think it is because it's where I'm at with food right now. I love heirloom recipes. I love traditional recipes. I love good old home cooking. And, you know, this has a literary twist, which I really like, too. So it was just probably the favorite project I've ever worked on in my life. I just loved it.
So tell me a recipe that kind of surprised you, something that maybe you didn't think sounded particularly good, but when you put it together, it was wonderful.
That's a hard one because I'm not sure it's surprising to most people, but for me, I've never been that excited, or I never really thought that much about gingerbread, but it's the one thing that Joe can make. Joe can make gingerbread.
Reliably, yes.
Right, and I made it, and I was like, you know, we've forgotten how good this is. There's nothing in the world like gingerbread, you know, like a moist gingerbread, and I put a little, just the way they did back in the day, I put a lemon glaze over it, and I just encourage everyone to give that recipe a try again, because it's a wonderful thing, but you've forgotten.
I was intrigued by how you interpreted a part of the book where Hannah, the housekeeper, who's been with the family throughout the lives of the girls, she makes hot turnovers for the girls throughout the winter months, and they carry their hot little hand pies with them because they don't have gloves.
Exactly.
So how did you interpret that? We don't get much information other than the girls carried them to keep their hands warm.
Right, exactly. Well, I found jelly turnovers were quite common, but I just kind of wanted to do something a little more special because sometimes the food was a little plain back then, but not always. Spices were big, I should mention, in New England, because the spice trade was really in full swing at the time. But I did want to make it a little more special. So a few of these recipes I made just a little, you know, added just something. And in this case, I added cheese to the turnover so that they're a savory turnover with a little sweet dot of jelly inside. And actually, I'm glad you mentioned it because I think that's one of my favorite recipes in the book. That's a good one.
Well, I definitely put that one on my list to try, especially in these cool weather months. So how did doing this research and writing these recipes change your relationship with the book Little Women, which I mentioned it before, but it's such a touchstone book for so many of us.
I think it just brought me closer to it. It made me realize what a masterpiece it really is. And I'll probably read it again in my life because it is a great book.
I want to bring your aunt into the conversation now. And first, I also want to mention that you're going to be at Beaverdale Books Wednesday, October 16th. So I guess that's tomorrow
that's
evening
tomorrow.
At 6:30 p.m. with the Little Women Cookbook.
And there will be treats.
Oh,
but no pickled limes.
Do you want to tell us what the treats are, or is that a secret?
It's just some of the really good cookies in the book will be there, and a few of the picnic sandwiches as well.
All right, delightful. All right, I want to bring your aunt into the conversation, because really, what are the odds that a niece and an aunt in the same family would be bringing out books in the month of October, different books, although I do find a common thread between thinking about Little Women and Surprise Lily by Cheryl Byers Moranville. As I mentioned before, it's her seventh book, a novel for middle grade readers. And it does feature, like Little Women does, strong and intriguing female characters. It explores mother-daughter relationships, the bond between sisters, the power of family legacies and secrets. Cheryl, thank you so much for being here.
I'm so glad to be here, Charity. I listen to you every day, and it's truly a treat to be behind the mic with you.
Well, it's so fun to have you here. And before we dig into Surprise Lily, I want to talk about the two of you, because this is such an awe-defying event that both of you brought out books in the month of October. When did you realize, Cheryl, that you were both publishing this month?
It was not very long ago at all that we realized that our pub dates were within days of each other and our book launch parties are within days of each other. So it's been so much fun to walk this road with Winnie and, you know, talk about the process of editors and reviewers and ARCs and all those geeky things that you have to have a writer friend to talk to about. And so I had a friend and a relative, which was wonderful.
Well, and the two of you are related by marriage. Winnie, when did the two of you first meet?
Well, I think it was 1969. We always thought that my Uncle Barry, that's my brother's younger, my father's younger brother, he's like, 13 years younger than my father. We always thought Uncle Barry was going to be a bachelor. And then one day he brings his beautiful young bride to town, and there's our Aunt Cheryl, and we've been smitten ever since. And over the years, you know, we're not that far. She's not really, you know, a traditional, old enough to be my aunt, so we're really closer in age than one might expect. So over the years, she's, like Cheryl said, she's become a friend and, you know, more like a sister, really.
Yes.
Well, how old were you, Winnie, when the two of you first met?
I was 9.
All right. And so, Cheryl, reading Surprise Lily, it's very clear that you are not a person, at least in this point of in your life, to underestimate the fortitude and creativity and intelligence of a 9 or 10-year-old, because all of the protagonists in your new book are about 10 years old
yes.
when you write about them. But did the two of you bond over your love of books even way back then?
Oh, I remember giving Winnie a book of poetry for Christmas.
Miracles. I still have it.
I don't think we really began to bond over our love of literature until we both were on the fringes of academia. Neither of us were ever fully into academia. But we both liked teaching, and we both taught literature and writing. And Winnie's husband, Dave, had a book of poetry come out about the same time. Winnie's collection of short stories called The Record Player came out. And shortly thereafter, my first novel came out. And I just felt so honored to be joining this pair in Barry's family who had already claimed a place in the publishing world.
That's wonderful. Well, and Cheryl, let's focus on you, and let's talk a little bit about Surprise Lily. Maybe you could start us off by reading a little bit from the first chapter of the book.
I would be glad to, Charity. The main character's name is Rose. So, chapter one, Rose. Rose threw on yesterday's clothes and hurried downstairs. She'd stayed awake worrying about her oral report and then had overslept. In the mudroom, she stepped into her boots and ran along the lane to the barn. She waved at her grandmother, Amma, who the rest of the world called Tulip, as Amma was opening the chicken house door. colorful birds flapped out, looking as groggy as Rose felt, and began their soft clucking. Rose squinted against the morning light bouncing off the barn roof in the grain silo. Myrtle, their border collie, ran to greet Rose with a quick kiss on her wrist. Amma called, "How are you this morning?" "I couldn't sleep," Rose said. "Ah," Amma said, understanding. "You'll do fine today." She might, but it was going to be so hard talking in front of everyone. At the barn, Peanut Butter waited at the gate of her pen, dancing with eagerness. When Peanut Butter was born in March, her mama wouldn't claim her. So Amma and Rose had carried the little calf to the barn and bottle-fed her and kept her warm and safe in a stall. She was a creamy tan color and had the softest eyes in the world. So they had named her Peanut Butter. Grabbing the shears that hung outside Peanut Butter's stall, Rose said, "I'm hurrying as fast as I can." Peanut Butter was old enough now that she had only an evening bottle. She ate fresh hay and dried calf food in the morning. There was an alfalfa pasture behind the barn, and Rose cut a fistful of stems. She ran back to the pen and hand-fed Peanut Butter a few stems, then put the rest in the feeding tray. Because she knew what was coming, when Rose reached for the coil of rope, Peanut Butter ducked away. But Rose caught her and tied one end of the rope to the brake halter and the other to a post. Cows were not by nature gentle to people. But in 2 months, Rose would need to lead Peanut Butter around at the fair as her 4-H project. Peanut Butter yanked and tossed her head, but she'd learned that if she quit fighting, the brake halter loosened. So she settled down and let Rose brush her and scratch under her chin. As she did every morning, Rose told her what a fine calf she was and how much she'd enjoy the fair. Rose left Peanut Butter tied while she cleaned and refilled the water bucket, cleaned the food bucket, and weighed out dried food. Then she praised Peanut Butter for being a very good girl and untied her. Before she left, she fed Peanut Butter a handful of pellets, letting the calf suck her fingers. "See you tonight," Rose said, wiping her hand on her shorts. "Wish me luck."
That's Cheryl Byers-Moranville reading from her new novel for middle grade readers. It's called Surprise Lily. And Cheryl, do you have an agricultural background?
I do indeed. I did not grow up to be a farmer, but I come from farmers. I come from farmers and teachers. And my sister, Beverly, is a farmer. I was raised as a house kid. My parents were probably not well married. My dad wanted to be a farmer, and my mom did not want to be a farm wife. So she picked me, the first kid, to be a house kid. And then my next sister got to be the farm kid. And then my last sister got to choose.
to be whatever she wanted to be.
When I was actually working on the details for this book, I had to lean heavily on the expertise of my farmer sister.
Well, the details of life on the farm are so authentic and do ring true. And
thank you.
There's this cluster of houses, this cluster of land, all of these farms that belong to members of the same family. And is that part of your history as well? Was there a cluster of relatives around you growing up on the farm?
Yes, and those same houses are still there, and my people are still in them. One cousin occupies my great-grandparents' home, and another cousin occupies my grandparents' home. We cherish our family history and our family.
Is this the first time you've written about that history in a novel? Has it made an appearance in other books?
Well, my very first book, Over the River, Willem A., the main character, had a farm background, but quite early in the story, she gets hauled off to Oklahoma by her dad, recently returned from the military. So That's more about relationships in Oklahoma. He's an electrician struggling to make a living. I'm trying to think. A Higher Geometry, the main character does live on a farm, but that's mainly a love story. So this is the first book that really sort of fully acknowledged and explored my family history. I want to make clear this is a work of fiction.
Right, right, absolutely.
And no relatives will be able to see themselves there.
Or if they do, you're saying that's their imagination, not
yours. I am indeed. Right. I deny everything.
You focus mainly on the women of this family, the Lovell family that is the center of the book. Why focus on the women?
Well, I think it's somewhat because I am a woman. And I have had incredibly wonderful men in my life. My grandfather, I lived with my grandparents when I was young because it was during World War II. My grandfather was such a role model. My dad was a fine man. But I tend to view life in terms of matriarchy.
Interesting. You know, we're going to have to take a break. Do. We'll talk more about that in just a moment. Cheryl Byers-Moranville is with me. We're talking about her novel, Surprise Lily. We were talking earlier with Winnie Moranville. Her book is The Little Women Cookbook. And we will talk more in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me now is writer Cheryl Byers-Moranville. We're talking about her latest novel. It's called Surprise Lily. It's her seventh book, and this one is a novel for middle grade readers. It's about sisters. It's about mother-daughter relationships, the power of family legacies and secrets. And Cheryl, just before the break, we were talking about the fact that this book focuses on the women in one family.
Yes.
And how you tend to think about families in terms of matriarchy. Tell me more about that.
Well, I think we are the sum of our experiences. And I have experienced life as matriarchal. And in my own marriage, I felt oh, my. I had the most wonderful husband in the world. Winnie can confirm this. He was a wonderful man, and I miss him terribly. As I say, I have always had good men in my life. But, Charity, I have to tell you, I think the world is likely to work better if women are in charge.
I'm probably 52% of our listeners fully agree with you on that, at least, and maybe a few more as well. Let's talk a little bit more about the Lovell family in this book, because as I mentioned, you focus on the women in the family, and you focus on three different generations, or maybe actually four different generations in this family. And you mentioned Rose earlier. She really is the main character in the book, and she's 10 years old when we meet her. But you also travel back in time, and we meet these other women in the family. We meet Harriet Jane when she was 10 years old, and we meet Clara when she was 10 years old. So we spend some time with these women, and Iris when she was 10, right?
Yes.
So we spend some time with these women when they were girls. What did you want to show in these snippets?
Well, actually, to do that was sort of suggested to me by my wonderful editor at Holiday House. She has done two books with me now, and I've learned so much from her. But what she's learned about me is I want my characters, like real people, to come to page one with a real backstory. And I know I am the locus of all that came before me. And so I approached Rose that way. And so I would have her, in the first iteration of this story, Rose was the only narrator. But by way of telling her story, she and Amma and Iris needed to talk about these people. And as you know, because you've read the book, the backstory, there's a lot of secrets in there and a lot of dysfunction and some mental illness and some harsh emotional harshness. And finally, my editor said, well, since these past generations are so important to fully telling Rose's story, what would you think of letting the matriarchs who have come before her speak in their 10-year-old time and place? And my first thought was, that's going to be hard. And my second thought was, but it could just be wonderful. So although it extended the time for completing the project by quite a little, I'm so glad I did it.
Absolutely. Well, and it makes each one of those characters, of course, we all make mistakes in life, and each one of those characters has made mistakes in her life. But by meeting them all as 10-year-olds, I think the reader approaches them with so much more empathy.
Yes.
Because we can see who they are at their core.
And the forces that were weighing on them. You know, 10-year-olds have some agency, but they don't have total agency.
It's interesting, as you introduce us to these different women through time, how the world around them changes. Our heroine, Rose, has a lot of responsibility and a lot of agency for a 10-year-old in modern life. But that's largely because of her Amma.
Yes.
And because it's kind of an old-fashioned relationship and life on the farm, and it's just the two of them. So she has to take on a lot of responsibility. But a lot of 10-year-olds today are more firmly rooted in childhood, I would say, than Rose's.
I would say so, too. But, you know, did she not have that strength, she could never have carried off the great fait accompli of saving her little sister and putting that family back together.
And she is an extraordinary 10-year-old and a wonderful protagonist for the book. Cheryl, I want to talk a little bit about your journey before we run out of time today. Being a writer was not something that you grew up thinking about doing, was it?
No, not at all. My journey to being a writer, if I tell the truth, it's embarrassing.
Well,
you
want to
hear the embarrassing
yes.
truth. Okay, I came to being a writer by way of flubbing being a math major in college. In those years, women were not encouraged in math and the sciences, and I wanted to be a math major, but it was just, frankly, so antagonistic that my junior year, I switched my major to English.
Well, and I'm not going to place the whole onus on you there and say that you flubbed your major. That sounds like a pretty hostile environment. But so you switched to English because that just seemed like a more welcoming place, or was it something you were interested in?
I was always an English minor, and I got so much encouragement from the faculty that, you know, they welcomed me, and that felt really good, but it meant I had to just really lay on the credit hours to get graduated because I was a junior by then. So I got shunted into a creative writing class, which I thought would be maybe some poetry, some short stories, but it was a novel writing class. And so
they didn't advertise that up front.
No, they did not advertise. And the professor was a man from England. And, oh, I don't know, I was very intimidated. But he basically said, look, if you're going to take my class, you have to write a novel. And I said, okay. So in 9 months, I wrote a novel. And, of course, what I discovered was it was the happiest I had ever been in my life because I could love characters into being, characters that had not existed before. I could bring into being. It was a heady experience. So my friends would be out on Friday and Saturday night doing the college student thing, and I'd be in the dorm room with my coffee pot and my portable typewriter, just having the time of my life. And my professor really liked the manuscript. He liked it well enough that he showed it to his American agent. I still remember his name, Leo Amster, in New York. And the agent liked my manuscript, too, and he agreed to represent me. And I was over the moon, of course.
Sure.
And my professor went back to England, and in 6 weeks or so, from the agent, I received what I now know was just a routine editorial letter telling me things I needed to do to make my manuscript stronger before he started taking it around to publishers. But Charity, I was only 21. I had no knowledge pool to turn to with this. My friends weren't writers. My family, they weren't writers. And in my naivete, I took umbrage at this letter that he would dare to think my little opus wasn't perfect. So I wrote to him and said, please send my manuscript back. And I went on to do my master's and my doctorate, and I worked in the corporate world, in the teaching world, in the child advocacy world, and then in the mid-90s, I remembered that wonderful feeling.
So that was it for you, you thought? That was the end of it?
The end of it. And the wisdom and maturity brought me back to it. And after only 103 rejections, I sold my first book and got a wonderful agent who's still my agent, and she sends me all kinds of editorial letters, and I no longer take umbrage. I realize they're a great gift.
That's so fascinating. I mean, just when you were 21 years old, just getting criticism shut you down.
Yep.
And yet, so many years later, you were able to deal with flat-out rejection.
Yes.
So what do you think changed in you during that time? What made it possible for you to make yourself vulnerable and to be so brave? Because that is a really scary thing to do.
It is. My husband, who learned after about the 27th rejection letter in the mail, he learned to spot them. And he would come in and lay them down on the counter. And one day he put his arm around me and said, I don't know how you do it. And I think what happened is I simply grew up and learned that life is hard and you have to try to do what you think you want to do and not be turned away like I was when I wanted to be a math major. You know, I learned to take criticism and to fail.
When you think of probably mostly little girls who'll be reading your book, Surprise Lily, are you trying to give them a little bit of that courage and strength?
Absolutely. That is that, other than my personal pleasure in creating, I love the idea that I might be showing 10-year-olds that although they're not in charge, the grown-ups are in charge, but still they have hearts, they have rapidly developing brains, and they have imagination. And they can do a lot with those things.
And sometimes they see things more clearly than the grown-ups around them.
Exactly. And sometimes they see that maybe they don't see things clearly, but the grown-ups don't either. You know, everybody's sort of all in this family business together.
I'm talking with Cheryl Byers-Moranville. Her latest novel is Surprise Lily. It's a book for middle grade readers, and it's about sisters and mothers and daughters and families and secrets. Also with me, Cheryl's niece, Winnie Moranville, food writer, who just published The Little Women Cookbook, Tempting Recipes from the March Sisters and Their Friends and Family. And we only have about 5 minutes left here, but I would love to get a little insight from both of you, because both of these books are directed mainly toward young readers and mainly toward young women, because let's be honest, most of the readers of Little Women are girls and women. And as I mentioned, Cheryl, your book will probably appeal mostly to girls, although I think a boy could certainly enjoy it as well. But what do you hope that maybe a young reader could learn from your personal journey. Winnie, can you tell us?
Oh, that's a good question. I hope that, I just hope that people look at this book and see how people really cared for each other through food. And food was basically love made visible. And I went through a period in my life where food was more, it was entertainment, you know, it was, I hate to say status, because I tried never to really make it that way. But, you know, you did try to make really fancy, wonderful things. And you tried to know a lot about food. And I'm just really dialing that back and just making about bringing people together over just a good meal and letting food take its rightful place. And I think the food cooking shows have made everybody, you know, elevate the food to be more important and more, you know, more focused than I think a gathering really needs it to be. I think it should just have its rightful place rather than be the focus.
In revisiting Little Women, which you first read as a 13 or 14 year old, did that also put you in touch with the 13 or 14 year old Winnie in a different way?
I wish I could remember it that way. I do remember just thinking that Amy, you know, the character of Amy was just so cool because she just, you know, I mean, she gets in trouble, she has downfalls, but she's always just, you know, she has this equilibrium and is able to just kind of soldier through everything. I think that she impressed me the most.
Really?
For that. Oh yeah, Amy's amazing. She you know, she's the littlest sister, but she's also the most poised. You know, she charms people right and left, and you know, I was kind of gangly and skinny and awkward, and she just seemed to have a lot of, you know, she's just very cool.
Interesting. Well, would you have I said that you identified most with her as one of the four sisters?
Well, I think that because she was probably closer in age to me, I sort of had my eye on her most. Uh-huh. You know how you are when you're a little girl, you're looking at, you know,
right,
other girls.
I
and
thought we
see,
all wanted,
you know,
to grow up to be Joe, so I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, Joe's very cool too, but she, you know, she was kind of out of my league when I was 13, right?
All right. Well, and I'll let you have the final word, Winnie, but in writing about all of these 10-year-old girls and thinking about your personal journey, what do you want maybe a young aspiring writer to get from your experience? What would you want her to know?
I would want her to know that love is really sort of what pulls and pushes the world along, particularly love in the family. And sometimes this love is really helpful, and sometimes it's an obstacle, but you just need to hang in there with all you've got.
Well, thank you both so much for being here today. What a pleasure to talk
My
to
pleasure,
both of you.
My pleasure, Charity.
It was great. And thank you for having us both on. It was very meaningful for us.
Yes. Well, wonderful. And what an incredible treat. And what a wonderful coincidence. Congratulations to both of you on your
thank
book.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Winnie Moranville. She is a food writer, and she has just published The Little Women Cookbook, Tempting Recipes from the March Sisters and Their Friends and Family. She will be having her book launch party tomorrow night at Beaverdale Books, October 16th, 6:30 p.m., and there will be treats, she says. I was also talking to Cheryl Byers Moranville. Her seventh novel just came out this month. It's called Surprise Lily. It's for middle grade readers, and it's about mothers and daughters. It's about family legacies, the power of secrets, and what little girls can be capable of when they set their minds to it. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Matt Alvarez, Dennis Reese, Caitlin Harrop, and Rick Brewer. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can follow us on Twitter at Iowa Public Radio. And of course, you can subscribe to our podcast. Never miss an episode. Subscribe to the Talk of Iowa podcast wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Charity Nebbie.